Hello and welcome to Humanities and Theology at Lund University. My name is Martin DeGrelle. I am here with Aaron Goldman, who is a researcher at the Center for Theology and Religious Studies. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I listened to your presentation during the Humanities and Theology Days in April, where you talked about the sort of the religious aspects of the QAnon movement and the concept of Donald Trump as a sort of religious hero for the right-wing crowd in America. And I immediately was interested in having you in here in the studio to talk about that. So I think many people who listen to this know somewhat about, like, of course they know Donald Trump, but do they know a whole lot about QAnon? I'm not sure. So just to have the basic sort of out of the way, what is QAnon and what is its origins?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. Thank you for having me here, too. It's also a pleasure that someone who's heard me speak in the past wanted to talk to me again. Normally, I experience the opposite phenomenon. The question, I take it, is about QAnon and just a broad overview of exactly what we're dealing with here. And I think it's probably not fair to say that no one knows exactly how to categorize it, because I think movements of this sort in general have not necessarily been radically uncommon throughout history, but things that sort of bridge the religious and the political, certainly. But what we saw was something a bit new with respect to how it was moving from an online ecosystem into sort of televised mainstream American politics and then spread a little bit around the world too. So in late 2017, and this is essentially how QAnon begins, someone calling themselves Q, indicating something related to a Q-level clearance, an intelligence classification in the U.S. government, begins posting on the 4chan image board. Now, the way 4chan works, and then it's sort of a subsequent websites, 8chan and 8kun, is that you don't necessarily have a reliable screen name. Everything is anonymized in that way. But you can track the same posters by way of IP addresses and some other information. So somebody calling themselves Q begins to post about Hillary Clinton and sort of builds from the Pizzagate conspiracy phenomenon from before. And it eventually attracts some attention. And over the course of the next couple of years, you see this Q poster, and people who are following Q begin to provide all sorts of interpretations of these bizarre accounts of political and intelligence apparatus in the U.S. deep state and so on. And what develops is what looks kind of like a cult of Donald Trump based on interpretations of posts by Q, which are known as crumbs or Q drops. So we'll start there, but feel free to ask any follow-up questions about this.
So I think the sort of the genius thing about the Q drops or the crumbs, they're mostly vague.
Yeah.
They are explicit in some senses, but mostly vague, which is sort of, that's the genius part of the movement, I think, because people can pick up the crumbs and sort of they can bake. They call
yes,
it baking.
Bakers.
Yeah. And so they can sort of pick up the crumbs or the drops and just run with it and sort of create these fantastical sort of side intrigues. And,
yes.
And I think there's almost like an element of like gamifying.
Yes, very much. It seems that this phenomenon is interesting to people for a number of reasons, but it picks up on social media and essentially it taps into a great deal of pre-existing spiritualist and conspiracist accounts of all sorts of things. You have lizard people that are factored in. It essentially becomes a sort of grand conspiracy theory of conspiracy theories that is centered around Donald Trump as someone who will ostensibly lead the United States through a period of darkness into presumably a period of healing through a couple of important steps, the awakening and the storm, in which, and I suppose we haven't mentioned this yet, Donald Trump helps to bring about the trials or even executions of supposed pedophiles among those people who are working in U.S. government and even around the world in various positions. Hollywood actors are listed and so on.
Yeah, because despite all the vagueness, at the core of QAnon is kind of a fantastical conspiracy about like blood-sucking liberals and Hollywood people and the elites and
The demonic figures are almost unilaterally ostensibly left-leaning American political folks and people connected to them, though there are a variety of people who've been included in the list. But it's essentially a charge that recycles old canards, anti-Semitic canards and other things, as well as channels things from the Satanic Panic in the 80s and 90s. And so you see these things replayed.
And so Donald Trump has been a presence here since day one, basically. Why is that? Or how has he been a presence in the Q drops and so on?
He's mentioned explicitly in a number of them, and some people at first theorized that Trump was himself posting them, which seems just on the face of it absurd for a number of reasons. But he serves almost in – I don't know. I'm alluding to a remark made on another podcast I've heard at this point, but he's almost serves as a white hat pedophile, as it were, like someone who had been able to infiltrate sort of business, Hollywood, and political elite at that point in order to kind of tear it down from the inside. And that would be the way that he serves as a sort of hero. Now, the way he serves as a religious hero, maybe we wait till later on that, but he's certainly figured in this movement as someone that it's interested in, someone who would be a sort of savior, who would come out and, as a political figure, bring about the storm.
Then we sort of enter into the realm of the biblical and the apocalyptic imagery and so on, because that's been a huge part of QAnon lore and sort of the reactions to it. And the journalist Will Sommer, he calls QAnon, or I should say, he interprets how QAnon is maybe felt or experienced by its acolytes as like a biblical struggle between good and evil, which is, of course, straight up religious imagery.
Right.
And so it seems like also the religious themes are sort of also baked in from the beginning almost.
Yeah. And so on the one hand, I think that there's a scholar named David Robertson who's written a book on UFO religions and conspiracisms in the 20th century. And he's a good person here to look at, because he identifies the fact that conspiracy theories and conspiracism have not necessarily been specifically secular, right? They've often incorporated these religious elements, and there have often been conspiracies about religions and religious conspiracy theories and so on and so forth, right, throughout history. And so there certainly is I would say it's not radically new that we have a conspiracy theory that involves a battle between good and evil, something to that effect. However, it does seem that a lot of people from mainstream American evangelical Protestantism, I should say, have been sort of pulled into this, or they find it to be attractive for some reason. There was a survey conducted, I want to say, in 2021 by a group that isn't necessarily reliable. It would be a conservative a research think tank. But they found that something like 27 to 29% of surveyed American evangelical Christians did believe that QAnon was mostly or completely accurate. Now, I think these sorts of surveys are really hard to perform when a community is mostly identified by what they're posting online, when they're already suspicious of sorts these kinds of research activities, and when it's unclear what it would mean to think that QAnon is mostly or completely accurate. So we don't know what most people who subscribe actually are committed to. Right. Maybe they think that there is a quote-unquote pedophile cabal doing things, right? maybe they don't identify the same people. There's some people that think that JFK Jr. will be resurrected from his supposed death in a plane crash, or he faked his death. And some of these people were hanging out at Dealey Plaza in 2021 in November, waiting for JFK Jr. to come back. They thought, some thought, that he had come back in the form of a man named Vincent Fusco, or Fusco. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce that guy's name, but that guy was not JFK Jr., pretty patently.
Yeah, but he showed up, has been showing up to a lot of the QAnon conventions and meetups and sort of skirting the issue.
Oh, yeah. No, he's very clever with the way he handles it.
He's really making the most of his 15 minutes.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, who can blame the guy, right? I'd be tempted to do the same. but yeah, so there are these kinds of I guess I wanted to say two things. Yes, there is a religious element baked in, presumably related to how politicized the theology and how theologized the politics are of evangelical Protestants, specifically white evangelical Christians in the U.S. And also that it is not necessarily a monolithic quasi-religion or something to that effect. We don't know what most people think. Most people may think the JFK Jr. stuff is not, to be brought in. It's something to be excluded, or it's not particularly interesting. Something to that effect. It's hard to say.
So, looking at QAnon as a quasi-religious movement, in what ways is QAnon not a real religious movement, if you like?
So what makes me hesitant to say, like, oh yeah, that's for sure a religion, right? I suppose I want to be very cautious here, and scholars of new religious movements often have to be cautious about such things. I'm not a scholar of new religious movements myself. I do philosophy of religion for my day job, as it were. But you don't want to declare something as not a religion simply because you don't think it looks nice, right? Like the label of cult or something like that has the potential to be problematic, at least. And so I want to be cautious about that myself. But there are reasons to not call it a religion, mainly that it doesn't necessarily have that much coherence, and it doesn't necessarily involve yet all sorts of rituals and in-person gatherings, which we would normally associate with religious traditions. One could maybe list some other things, right? It's an oft-debated topic in religion, in the study of religion, I should say, what a religion actually is. And so that would be a debate we would have to have first before I could make any sort of claim definitively. But, you know, there are some in-person gatherings, these sort of like Save the Children rallies and so on. But it doesn't seem that most people do them. These things are all unclear.
Yes, that's an aspect of it being primarily an online movement as well, because people do gather IRL, mm-hmm. as it were.
In the meat space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as you said, it's kind of difficult to gauge whether these cliques, are they representative of the whole lot, or,
right.
or are they, and as you mentioned before, are they all in on every aspect of the QAnon conspiracies,
yeah.
or not? It's very hard to tell,
yeah.
right?
And here, I hope it's okay to do this. I'm going to be a little critical of Will Sommer, who's an excellent journalist, and I'm grateful he's written so sensitively about a lot of this and has great access, and he's a good writer in general. But in the Trust the Plan book, which came out recently, he'll say things at times. I think it was in reference to the Frazzle Drip video, which you can do a cursory Google of, but I recommend not a deep dive Google of. But it's a video supposedly of Hillary Clinton doing something obscene. And he makes a comment, something like QAnon believers believe that even viewing it could be fatal. And I find it really hard to believe that that's the case of most people who subscribe to QAnon. My suspicion is most wouldn't even know what it is. Some might, right? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
So shifting gears mm-hmm. a little bit here, another very interesting layer to this political / quasi-religious world or movement is the aspect of professional wrestling.
Yeah.
And so I was very intrigued when you talked about in your presentation about, I think it's the first time I've heard in an academic setting, someone explaining kayfabe and how that idea, that concept interacts with the political life in America. So can you just sort of explain the concept of kayfabe?
Yeah, of course. I'll get there. I'm going to get there as fast as I can here.
I imagine
the audience is like, oh, so now we're talking about professional wrestling. Well, here's why, right? So some of the research that I'm doing, and I'm still in the sort of hypothesis crafting phase, it's motivated by a couple of observations about the U.S. political landscape. And one of those is that something that looks like a quasi-religious political movement, this QAnon group, did emerge around Donald Trump. And that seems to be noteworthy, right? How quickly it developed and the kind of power it seemed to have, at least pretty quickly. That's one thing. And the other thing was just the fact of Donald Trump's electoral success against the political backdrop of American electoral politics. And so what I think actually bridges those two observations is a certain type of political style that Donald Trump is engaged in, a certain type of performance that replicates and participates in kayfabe. So I'll explain what that is. Kayfabe is a certain type of fictive performance that is, I think, most prominently, but not exclusively, in American professional wrestling. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, American professional wrestling is not actually a sport. It is a type of theatrical performance that is often televised, in which people come and they watch it and often participate in viewing it as though it were actually a sporting competition. But it is not a sporting competition. It involves athleticism, certainly, because the actors in the ring, and I'm sure some of you have seen Mr. T or The Rock or Jesse Ventura, all, you know, governor of Minnesota formerly, right? Like, have been in this environment at points in their career. And so maybe you're familiar with some of these images, but it's a staged fake fight that is actually acting. But what makes it kayfabe is that the scene of the theater, in this case, generates a sense that it is not fake. So when you normally go to watch a play or you watch a movie, you don't really think that the actors on the screen or in the theater, right, are actually there, that this is really happening. You don't act like that. There's actually a barrier between you and what you're seeing. You can suspend disbelief, but you don't really think that you're watching Oppenheimer on camera, right? Something like that. You don't really think you're watching Barbie and Ken, the real ones. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
But there's a way in which that sort of reality-unreality distinction is blurred in kayfabe. Maybe children think it's real. Adults don't think it's real when they go to a wrestling event, but they're still rooting for someone to win. And so that's a specific kind of dynamic that not all theatrics have.
Yeah, it's like nobody is fooled by what's happening. And yet they participate in it as if they are fooled, or and also the sort of the constant breaking of the fourth wall.
Yeah.
If you look at the stage of the wrestling, you know, ring as a stage.
Yes.
They constantly, you know, extends the scene.
Yes.
Or the stage beyond it. And also, I think the idea of kayfabe is, it's such an important part of wrestling to the point of, like, you can't even make wrestlers break kayfabe, even in like an interview setting like this, for instance.
Yes.
They won't. They keep the facade there.
Yeah, they stay in character.
They stay in character.
Right? Like they're acting when they're being interviewed or something, right?
Even though in the interviewer, the audience, everyone knows it's sort of a it's a put on. But they are still in character.
Now there's one. I want to draw attention to. First of all, you're right. Like Martin, I want to highlight the fact that what you discussed, where the stage kind of enlarges when you're watching it, it contributes to this idea, right? You have like someone come up and hit someone else over with a chair, like a folding chair that's ostensibly not in the wrestling ring, but it really is. It's part of the performance, right? And so there's this blurring that happens. two observations to make here. One is that Trump has been actually involved in professional wrestling, and he's a personal friend of Vince McMahon, who's the primary shareholder of WWE. And both of them have been on stage, as it were, in the ring together, one in which Trump shaves his head, Vince's head, and so on. And so you see Trump has actually been in this environment.
Yeah, he's like
before.
A character, or a heightened version of himself.
Yes, and maybe that's a question. Yeah. Was he really a heightened version of himself? Because there's a story, and it was told by another professional wrestler, and, you know, so of course no one knows if this is true, but there was a storyline in one of the seasons of WWE. I don't remember which particular performance series it was, but in which Vince McMahon's limousine explodes. So it doesn't really explode. It's TV, right? But Trump supposedly made a phone call to someone and said, "Is Vince all right?" And so it raises questions about the possibility that Trump is as good at using this kind of dynamic, this sort of styling, because he actually doesn't himself experience the doubleness of being outside the character. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, speculative, sure, because I hesitate to speculate, but, well, I do it endlessly. But professionally, I hesitate to speculate about Donald Trump's personality. But it raises questions there.
So in what way do you think – what's the connection then between kayfabe and Trump? Did he employ sort of aspects of kayfabe during the election cycles or at the rallies, or how does it interact?
Yeah. So this is sort of where my hypothesis crafting begins, and we'll eventually pull in QAnon too. So I'll do my best to narrate this. This is still, as it were, a mental work in progress. I should say also, I'm not the first person to observe this. There are a couple of scholars whose work I've been following. Sharon Mazur has worked for quite some time. She's a professor in, I want to say, University of Auckland. She works on wrestling as a sort of performance art or theatrical piece. It's a certain type of media and performance. And she has edited a book with others on populism and wrestling in 2020, I believe that book came out. And then Shannon O'Brien has written a book called Donald Trump and the Kayfabe Presidency, in which she's argued basically that Trump used his techniques from WWE to create a certain type of dynamic on the stage where he functions as the heel, essentially the bad guy you want to root for. I think she's absolutely right about that. I think we could dig deeper than what she argues, though, when she says that he uses these kayfabe techniques to allow the audience to participate in a certain type of reality crafting that unfortunately has foul ends, right-wing and often nationalist and racist ends. And so I think all of that's right. I would kick it up a step further, I think, and I would say this all happens in a dynamic, right, in a political scene in the U.S. where American electoral politics is already rendered a cosmic battleground by sort of the base of the American right wing, American evangelical Protestants, right? And so we already have them primed to look at these televised debates and the media landscape preceding a presidential election as a sort of cosmic struggle. So you already have that. And you also have this growing suspicion in a gradually immiserated American economy where people are sick and tired, I think. Maybe this is a truism, but maybe it's more than that, actually. The politicians are lying to them. They're recognizing that they're watching what is essentially kayfabe already when they're watching American politics, when they're watching cable news, or when they're watching presidential debates. And so when Donald Trump, maybe not self-consciously, but almost instinctively, becomes a wrestling heel in the American political stage, it sort of reveals that it's already been kayfabe, right? So and he's so much better at it than his opponents. So I feel, in other words, and here I'm actually sympathetic in a way to this kind of not the right-wing dimension of it, but this upsetness at American electoral politics, right? where people are tired of being fed the kayfabe pablum that they've been fed, and they want a more exciting version of kayfabe. And so in the Republican primaries, this would have been 2015 or maybe early 2016, I don't remember exactly when, but one of Trump's Republican opponents, Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon, gives an account that relays part of his biography when he claims he was saved by a belt buckle that kept him from being stabbed by a friend. So it's sort of a come to Jesus moment for him, where he realizes he needs to change his life, and it sets him in the right path, where he eventually becomes a neurosurgeon, then he eventually runs for president and so on. And Trump calls him out on it on stage, and he just says, that isn't real. We all know that that's a lie. How's a belt buckle going to stop a knife from stabbing him? And by performing this comedically, he reminds all of his listeners, he's right. We don't have to deal with this kind of bullshit, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm no Trumpist, of course. But there's something interesting about the way his wrestling performance critiques politics and the sort of American electoral politics in its media presentation, right? And I think that was very attractive to people. And all of a sudden, we see evangelicals get excited that the sort of political stage that they've already rendered theologized or a cosmic battleground is disrupted. And I think that's sort of where we see QAnon emerge in that space.
Exactly. Well, by sort of exposing his opponents as phony, or, you know, by being even more phony and sort mm-hmm. of calling mm-hmm. attention to it and yeah. calling out the illusion, as yeah. it were, and the farce of politics.
Yes.
He sort of gives that voice to the disempowered in a sense. But I suppose, like, such an act or a pose sort of necessitates a society where trust in politicians and institutions are quite low.
Well, I think so. And I think that
I mean, it was ripe for that
yes.
kind of approach, if you will.
I think exactly. And this is something that I've published about with some degree of hesitancy. But there are – like, the American government has done some bad things. And some things that were once conspiracy theories are pretty clearly not only theories. You know, there's – Tuskegee incident is just one example. And then when you get to COVID and the idea of vaccination and people being hesitant, there's a history of the U.S. government using vaccination medical care as a smokescreen to do something pretty gross. So yeah, the U.S. government and institutions that have a certain type of knowledge authority are not trusted. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So I guess many people who are listening to this are probably, or even before, of course, fascinated and or repulsed by the sort of QAnon
yeah.
movement and this idea of Trump as sort of some kind of savior.
Right. No, of course.
The spectacle of it all.
Yeah.
So speaking as a researcher mm-hmm. in the field of religion and theology, as a researcher, what do you find most interesting about this? Because I'm guessing you have sort of a personal reaction to all this, and
yeah.
you also have sort of the academic side. So what is interesting from an academic perspective?
Sure. So I'll differentiate, I suppose, the personal and the academic.
Well, I mean, it's hard.
But I can do it a little bit. I mean, of course, there's part of me that loves hearing these stories of individual QAnon followers and so on doing things that are a little absurd. And so in a way, I like the spectacle of it. And in a way, I can kind of appreciate, in an abstract way, the silliness of Donald Trump emerging into a political landscape, even though, of course, it's what happens is really horrible, right? So I don't want to dismiss that or diminish that. But I guess personally, I find a lot of this entertaining, if I'm being honest. Professionally, I find it very interesting why it seems that a certain type of political critique by people who either are or perceive themselves to be disaffected by mainstream American politics and mainstream media knowledge authorities and so on, why they resist making critiques that seem like they would be relatively easy to make. I'm thinking of, broadly construed, a Marxist critique of American economy and politics and so on. And instead, they end up leveling a set of almost primordial taboos, right? Child eating, child rape, and so on. And instead of identifying the structural factors that cause at least their perceived disaffectation, why they turn to a hypothesis about essentially vampires and demons, right? So that is really bizarre to me. And it's also what bridges the religious studies and the political science sort of approaches. So I'm really fascinated by the opportunity to look at the ways that people express their critical energy and why the sorts of narratives and myths that emerge instead of what to me seems like a much more obvious critique to make. So that's professionally the case. And I'm working on this with two different research projects right now. There's a large one called At the End of the World, A Transdisciplinary Approach to the Apocalyptic Imaginary in the Past and Present. And the PI for this one is Jane Svenningson, principal investigator is what the PI is. And that's a large one, 22 people total over, I think now, 5 universities in Sweden. And we're working for 6 years. And so my little chunk, at least for the first couple of years, is to look at right-wing conspiracism, specifically in the U.S. So I'm thinking of QAnon there. That's the group that I'm looking at as a sort of touchstone for apocalyptic beliefs and activities in the present day. And the other project is has 3 people on it. Patrick Friedland is the PI, and Rickard Andersson is a political scientist, and then there's me. And it's called Beyond Truth and Lies, Conspiracy Theories, Post-Truth, and the Conditions of Public Debate. And our goal there is to look at the political role that conspiracy theories have in the current post-truth, what's been labeled the post-truth political landscape. So the former project is funded by Riksbanken Jubileumsfund, the latter by LMK Foundation. And the work I'm doing is sort of bridging both those things.
So academic research sometimes moves a bit slowly.
Yeah.
Has there been any research done yet apart from your project that you want to highlight or draw attention to?
So I've already mentioned Shannon O'Brien, who has the book on Donald Trump and kayfabe, and I recommend that. It's a quick and easy read, and she's a good writer. There are also there's an edited volume I mentioned by Sharon Mazur, and I believe that's co-edited. There is another book that actually just came out by Michael Austin and Gregory Bach, and it just arrived in my mailbox, so I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But it's called QAnon, Chaos and the Cross, Christianity and Conspiracy Theories. And so my day job is to be, as it were, a Kierkegaard scholar. So we haven't talked about that today, but there are some overlapping names in that book and in the Kierkegaard world, as it were. And so it seems that this is now going to be a legitimate subfield. People are going to keep asking these questions.
Yeah, no doubt. So if the listeners to this want to dive deeper, but not too deep, maybe they're not in the position of like diving into like the
they don't want to start reading
academic.
All the Q drops. You mean? I mean, you can find them all online. They're pretty easy to access, and the website is quite well set up.
Yeah,
it's got a good search function. Yep.
If they want to dive deep into this and still sort of maintain a healthy distance.
Yeah.
Where should they turn? There's plenty of like podcasts and more. We mentioned Will Sommer before.
Yes.
Do you have any recommendations?
Well, I mean, I don't have too much beyond that. I think that anything that Will Sommer appears on is good. The QAnon Anonymous podcast is something that I haven't listened to all the way through, but honestly, it feels like professionally I probably should, and they're pretty strong. I check out some other left-wing podcasts that talk about this stuff online, and I welcome you to sort of Google those things. I won't name any of them specifically, not that I shouldn't, but feel free to look them up. Beyond that, I think the books that I've mentioned should be sufficient, or the authors specifically. But actually, so I don't know exactly when this will come out, but in early September, Beyond Truth and Lies will be hosting Shannon O'Brien to give an online webinar presentation about Donald Trump and kayfabe and QAnon. Or at least I've specifically asked her to talk about Donald Trump and QAnon, and I'm sure she'll do a fantastic job. She's really fun to listen to.
That sounds really interesting. Yeah. And so I think that does it for us today. Aaron, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. This is an absolute pleasure. So thanks so much.